Hello everyone and welcome to the Strange Library podcast. My name is Aiden.
And I'm Leroy.
And today we're looking at a rather wonderful piece called Shiver in the Pines.
Yeah, this is written by Manly Wade Wellman, and he certainly is manly. This is written in about the 1900s. I'm not sure I can pin down, because the collections are collected somewhere between 1963 and 1984, but it's clearly a period piece written in kind of like the Old West, Appalachian Mountains.
I got a sort of mid-1800s feel from it in the end.
Yeah, it's hard to place. There's no technology kind of like landmarks that we can point to, but it's definitely Old West. Mm. Definitely from the vernacular, it's definitely old-timey, kind of like American. Where's the Appalachians? Is that the South?
Oh, God, I don't know. I'm sure we can find that one out, but I don't know,
I'm sure we can find that out, but we probably won't.
The Appalachians.
Ah, North Carolina, there you go. I still don't know what that is.
Northeastern North America.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so Silver John, our hero, what did you think, Aiden?
I really liked him. John is a very cool hero. Yeah, this is a story I very much enjoyed. Yeah, I really like the way he talks, the way it's described. It's just a lot of fun. So shall we read through the synopsis and then we'll keep going about how fun this story is?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're going to do a quick synopsis of the plot points and we'll talk about how we felt about it afterwards.
Wonderful. You want to take it away?
Sure. Our hero, John the Balladeer, doing some old-timey air tasker work, is staying with a Mr. Hoge. Mr. Hoge, his daughter Sarah Ann, and their neighbours Mr. Eddie and his son Clay are having supper on the farm. John plays a stirring ballad and Sarah Ann and Clay start a dancin'. They are currently courting and looking forward to their wedding. Clay wishes he could buy Sarah Ann golden slippers, just like in the song. Mr. Eddie tells Clay that if he wants gold, he could ransack the mines left by the ancients.
A man approaches, his face pale and his silhouette a solid block, and asks if he can sit by them. He introduces himself as Reed Barnett. He asks the group what they know about the ancients and the mines. They talk about how the mines are at least 300 years old, with tales that they are older even than the Spanish settlers or the Native Americans.
Reed is touched by the hospitality of the group and offers Sarah Ann golden slippers from within his coat. He then claims he knows how to get to the mines and the gold inside them. If they tag along, they will split the findings equally. Clay, excited about finding gold to set up his new life, agrees, and the other men all decide to join.
Reed performs a magic ritual to guide them on their quest. Instructions written on a sheet of paper appear, saying they will succeed on their quest, but they need a special candle sold by Aram Harnum, and whatever he asks, they must pay it.
Aram Harnum, a failed preacher, kicked out of the church, is an outcast who lives on the outskirts of Rebel Creek and is feared by the locals. John describes, "I reckon I'd never seen a hairier man and a mighty few hairier creature." Aram offers the candle for $500, but when the group claims they don't have that kind of money, he settles for a debt with Mr. Hoge and Mr. Eddie's farm as collateral.
The group set off with the magic candle into the Black Pine Hollow. They stop when the candle dims, indicating they are near their prize, and start to dig. They uncover a huge slab of rock the size of a door that falls to the ground. Clay and Mr. Eddie see gold shining through the dirt and grab a handful.
Reed screams as a figure emerges from the newly formed cave. A man-shaped thing, swaddled in webby rags with a gleaming skull in his hand, crawls forth. The group all scrambles, but Reed and John stand their ground.
John, having faced his fair share of ghosts and monsters, slings his silver string guitar into the position. The silver, that's sure sudden death to witch stuff, and blasts the creature with a chord. The creature seems affected and John goes after him, exposing the creature as Aram Harnum. Reed turns on John and throws him down the rocks, and John realizes that the whole thing was a scam.
John looks up and sees Reed and Aram, now a third figure, a huge furry man with warty muscles and frog-like face, huge mouth and eyes and no nose. It swoops in and grabs the two con men and pulls them into the darkness. This prompts the rest of the group to flee the mines.
Clay and Mr. Eddie seem to have grabbed handfuls of gold coins, although they are crudely stamped and in a language nobody recognizes. A police officer comes looking for Reed, saying he was a street performer that started scamming people, and the group puts together that he and Aram were both trying to steal their land, never expecting that there was actually gold in the mines.
The group decides that whatever bad mojo comes with the gold isn't worth it, and trek back to return it. When they do, they find Aram and Reed, huddled in the corner, returned. The two scammers, now looking like they've aged, grey hair and balding, behave barely human, hunched on all fours and animalistic. They run off into the mines when released.
The rest of the group return home, where John describes how Sarah Ann kept the golden slippers she received, and she and Clay were married, with John even playing for them at their wedding.
Alright, so I have to note that this story is roughly about, I don't know, 6 pages long with quite large text. It seems to be that the stories I pick are very plot heavy, a lot happens. But I think that even with the amount of plot that happens, there's so much personality in the way that, because it's all spoken from first person from John the Balladeer for the most part, isn't it?
For the entirety, yes.
And he has such a distinct voice, and I can't help but love him.
He is wonderful. From the moment he speaks, so there's a couple of things I really liked about the way that the world starts. And it's basically, in that first instance, he lists off all of the characters, which, yeah, is Mr. Hoge, Mr. Eddie, Sarah Ann, Clay. And the way that he says it is he doesn't say, at the house with Mr. Hoge, Mr. Eddie, Sarah Ann, and Clay. He says, at the house with Mr. Hoge and Mr. Eddie and Clay and Sarah Ann. And so you instantly have this feeling that this is someone who doesn't necessarily think too far ahead in how they're talking, because someone who does would generally put like a comma after the name rather than just putting and slowly making the sentence as they go. And he also keeps repeating their names, which I thought was very clever, because it's something that people who are sort of talk in a more uneducated way, in a more sort of, well, rougher style, will tend to talk, because they'll say names a lot more than using pronouns. But it also really quickly reinforces who's who. And so I thought it was very clever, because you instantly got this feel of what this character sounded like, what he felt like as a person, who he was. And it also helped to tell the reader, here's each of the characters. We're going to repeat them over and over, because we know that you're not going to remember the names. So here they are, over and over again, like 3 times in a row, and now we can say a name and you'll know exactly who it is. I thought it was really clever.
Yeah, and I mean, just in tiny small sentences, we're able to paint really clear pictures. I know that we spoke about how clear the images of Mr. Hoge were, and even Reed, when he was described, were to you.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Reed is very clear described. There's a line later on when he conducts the ritual, which is a whole scam in the end, but when he conducts that ritual, he makes a star, he makes a pentagram, and then sets fire to it and has a piece of paper that magically has words written on it. But the fire he lights is this sort of white fire, and it makes everyone's sort of skin look pallid. John has this wonderful, dry sense of humor that it's sort of like you'll read it and then laugh and wonder why it is you've just laughed. And then it's like, oh, hang on. No, that was really funny. Because when he's talking about the light, he talks about how it makes everyone look sickly. And then he says, Reed Barnett needed no special light to be pale.
Yeah. And even just the way that he kind of like realizes how ridiculous he is as a person. At some point, he's trying to figure out the series of events that led them to go on this expedition, and who said yes first. It's like, well, Clay said yes because he really wants this gold for his new life. And then I guess I just kind of went along with it. Oh, I probably should have thought that through.
Yeah, I love that, because he goes down the list. He's like, Clay went. And because Clay went, his father went. And because his father went, his friend, who's Mr. Hoge, went. And then because, yeah, John's like, well, I've seen weird-ass shit. Let's see more weird-ass shit.
Yeah, he even says, like, in the moment, he's like, I don't stand idle when others go forward. But I think that's, like, a rote line. And then later on, he kind of clicks that it's all a scam. It's just like, wait, how did I fall for this? Oh, yeah, I guess I just kind of did.
Yeah, exactly. It's just sort of, he's remarkably relaxed for someone
who... Yeah, can't be helped.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the events happened, and here I am, a leaf in the wind.
Mm.
And I guess it'll happen again. I'm not bitter. Like, I'm probably going to get fooled again because of the nature of who I am.
Well, when he's standing there in the cave and the ancient, in quotation marks, appears, which is actually Aaron, I found it quite funny because he's listing off all of the stuff he has done.
Yeah.
And sort of comparing them. It's quite funny because I suddenly, for a lot of it, I'd gotten this vibe of, like, I say, this sort of this country bard. If any of our listeners have heard the artist Hardy, I just his feel, the way he writes his songs, that sort of feel I got from John, just this pretty rough and tumble dude who is pretty chill and just doing what he likes. But when he's listing off his sort of achievements, his feats, I got distinct Geralt's from Geralt of Rivia vibes. He was a country style Geralt.
Yeah, and obviously we're going to go back into my catnip, my weakness, which is blue collar heroes. Blue collar monster hunters.
Mm.
There is a Hellboy comic called The Crooked Man, which pays homage to John the Ballandier. I will actually dig that up and read that again tonight. Have you ever read much Conan the Barbarian?
No.
It's not dissimilar to Conan, except if Conan were more like Geralt, in that Geralt is like, you know, the gruff anti-hero, but is actually just the heart of gold.
Yeah.
And John the Balladeer is very much the same, except he doesn't have the gruff anti-hero part. He's just a nice guy. I think at some point he mentions that most of the reason that he wanted to go on this thing was like, well, I mean, Clay and Sarah Ann are lovely, even though he's just met them. And if I can help set them up, then great. Sure, I'm down. I'm going to get some gold too, probably, but yeah.
That was something I found really surprising, that he doesn't have that grizzled sort of feel. Like, he's seen a lot, and I feel like he sounds like he'd speak with that slow southern drawl.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to be the life of the party, but he's just happy, just chill. He's just sort of like, yeah, shit happens. We'll go with it. Who cares? Just...
I think he is the life of the party. I think that he is a quiet kindness and masculinity that really does draw people in.
I guess when I say not life of the party, I feel like...
He's not particularly loud.
Yeah, when people talk about the life of the party, people talk about jovial people. The image that I find gets brought to mind is generally someone who is loud and bombastic and very energetic, and I don't think he's any of those things. He's got the quiet kindness of an 80-year-old in the body of what appears to be something like a 45-year-old.
Yeah, he does mention at some point when like you said, the ancient popped up, and he's like, well, I've faced off ghouls and goblins before, like, and he lists the ones that he's faced.
Mm.
He is talking about other books. I have read The Ugly Bird, which is...
Yep.
Weirdly Lovecraftian. Ooh. Weirdly like cosmic horror. I think it's The Ugly Bird where he finds a pool at the top of a mountain that is a multi-dimensional like gateway. and hearing him describe what a multi-dimensional gateway is, like, well, that's there's a thing that goes into other times and other wares, like. And him doing the X-Files thing, or just the standard kind of, like, you know, the part in the sci-fi or horror where they do the exposition. It's like, well, this is a monster that's been hidden under a mountain for 20 years and is building up hatred. To hear him describe these cosmic horrors in such a... What's a good word for this?
Matter of fact?
Yeah, I'm looking for a word and it's going to bother me. Quaint way. Yeah, such a quaint way. It's so good. Like I said, these books are tiny. They're not super easy to find, but we can send some links to our listeners. I've got a new bookshelf, and I really would like to get my hands on some physical copies of these ones.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's the way he talks is wonderful. There's to continue on the idea of, like, to touch back on the idea of his dry humor. There's a great bit when they first meet Aram Harnum. God, what a name. He talks about the man talking, and he says, he spoke with a boom, and I recollected how once he'd studied to preach. And I thought that was hilarious, because I could see just that one sentence is this guy going, shit, he's loud. Oh, it's because he was meant to be a preacher. Yep, that makes sense. And it was just something hilarious about reading that line. He has the speech of a grizzled old person who has seen everything, but nothing is actually, like, bleak. Like, he's seen it all before, but it's like, oh, I've seen this all before. Rather than, oh, I've seen this all before.
Yeah, so there are some, more than some, kind of religious undertones of this whole thing. So if we haven't described it, John the Balladeer is a wandering kind of like, I don't know, he's a wandering bard, basically. But he distinctly talks about the power of good being a religious one, being a Christian one. You know, his guitar actually has silver strings, literal silver strings. And when he plays music, things that are evil or things that are like devilish recoil. He has power over these things. So it is kind of like a good versus evil in a very old sense, in a very, very literal sense in these books. And I find myself, even though I'm not a religious person, I find myself really drawn to it. I find myself really drawn to the idea of, like, especially with John's demeanor being, I'm going to help out my fellow man and I'm going to be like a light in the darkness. That type of Christianity is very appealing to me, and it makes me almost wish that I could be religious a little bit.
It's the sort of it's the positive aspect of it without any of the belief.
Yeah.
It's like going to church without being religious in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if we could get the good aspects of like a society that helps each other out without maybe the insane persecution part.
Yeah. Yes.
Um,
Oh, also, I was just reading through my notes quickly, and I realized, because speaking of the way he talks, he describes how one of the blokes pulls out a pocket watch, and he describes it as a silver turnip watch,
oh, I was hoping that you'd find out what that is.
which is a pocket watch
Okay.
because it looks like a turnip. That's genuinely the reason. So
Okay.
it's a late mid to late 1800s slang for a pocket watch, because a pocket watch looks like a turnip.
Okay.
So, when wondering when is this? So, late 1800s, I'd argue.
Yep. Yeah, okay. So did they say turnip watch or did they say turnip pocket watch?
No, turnip watch.
Okay. Yeah, so I absolutely had in my head like a 1990s like Ninja Turtles shaped watch, but it looked like a turnip instead.
Yep.
Like the action figures of that time were turnips. It's
No.
really old Simpsons joke.
Well, when I looked it up, I found it hilarious because it's slang, yes, but also that is 100% the sort of thing that I imagine he would make up, because I can imagine him looking at a watch that is, and he has to describe it. And being a man who's not very well read but is knowledgeable will have looked at that and gone, looks like a turnip. It's a turnip watch.
Yep, that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I found another line that I liked. So when he's describing Aram, because the thing to note is, and interpretation may vary on this one, even though Aram is a con man, he is practicing some kind of like black magic that he is affected by John's guitar. Or, I mean, it's subtle enough that he might just be kind of shaking his head, but it does look like Aram, when he's confronted, is affected by the light of, well, the good magic, which is John's guitar. And when they first see him, they're talking about how hairy he is, like supernaturally hairy, and his hand crawled in the basket like black furred spiders, and I could just see like a basket like with black furry digits kind of rifling through, and like
Yes.
such provocative language.
Well, it's funny you should mention that his magic. I got the distinct feeling, I don't know what the other stories say, but I got the distinct feeling that this is an alternate history style, where this world is full of magic and people know about it, because they talk about the ancients as this sort of old creatures who are fairly unknown but evidently did stuff in a way that you talk about dinosaurs.
Yeah, and I wonder if we're stumbling on some kind of old-timey racism here, because they distinctly say that this is that the ancients were there before the Spaniards and before the Indians. That's what they say. And I think it might be like one of those old Mayan kind of things where they're like, well, these people could never have built a civilization like that. It must have been some wild old race. I don't know whether there's precedent for this, like talk of like ancient people in the Americas, but I'd be interested to find out.
Maybe, yeah. I guess it was because there is evidently magic in this world, and
Yeah.
evidently monsters rock up. It felt like a, well, like a Witcher thing, where this is a world which readily has magic, readily has monsters, and people know about them. It's just not everywhere has them, and it's not that dense.
Yeah, so my understanding with the other stories is that because people are spaced out so sparsely, that the world is still unknown. Mm-hmm. Like, you're out there in the mountains. Maybe you see Yetis or old, like, monsters or something like that, but that's your corner of the world and you're never going to be able to tell people about it. Mm-hmm. Everybody has the folk tales in their town that they know about. It's like, oh, everybody knows we don't go up that mountain because there's a demon that lives up there.
Okay.
It kind of reminds me of Dark Tower. Did you ever read The Dark Tower?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so The Dark Tower is kind of like the world that was kind of a Camelot, but with Western gunslingers.
Okay.
And the world used to be filled with monsters, and the gunslingers kind of tamed the wild lands, and then they failed, and monsters kind of like took over and it turned into a wasteland again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like that. There's a force for good out there, and there is the unknown, which is the American unknowns. It is the Wild West, because it's unknown. This is at a time that we don't know what's over the horizon at all points.
No, that makes sense. Yes, so yeah, that's sort of what I'm saying. I didn't ever get the feeling that there was any ambiguity as to whether magic existed or not, or whether the ancients were actually just people.
Yeah.
I felt like it was very much, no, magic exists. The ancients are creatures.
They didn't bat an eyelid when Reed said, yeah, I'm going to do a spell.
Yeah, exactly. And they talk about as well the book, which Reed quotes a couple of times, and they're all surprised at him knowing that, because it evidently indicates he's knowledgeable of some of this stuff.
Yep, yep. And speaking of other real world things, it looks like all the songs which are quoted in italic text in the story are probably old actual folk songs from that period. Oh. The story is called Shiver in the Pines, and there is a verse that says, in the pines where the sun never shines, and I shiver when the cold wind blows, which I know from a Nirvana cover, for all you Gen X's and millennials out there, for a Nirvana cover of an old murder ballad called Where Did You Sleep Last Night?
Mm.
And they quote this directly. And so these, I'm guessing, are actually all old, like, folk songs.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I feel like that's sort of, it's fascinating because this story feels like he made it as realistic as possible, and then injected this sort of fantasy elements into it.
Yeah, it's almost magic realism to an extent. Less surreal, but
yeah, it's not quite surreal because it's very real. Everything feels real and grounded.
And there's stuff that they fully admit that they just don't have answers for. When the two are returned and they've gone feral, they say, "Ah, leave them be. Go, let them go live with the ancients." And somebody else says, the ancients are dead. Whatever was in that cave that grabbed them is what the ancients left behind."
Yes.
Even later on, Reed turns up and gives Sarah Ann's golden slippers because John mentioned it in the song, and that's how it gets brought up. But they said, "Well, hang on, John, did you, like, were you working with them? Because how did he know about the golden slippers if it was all a scam?" And John goes, "I don't fucking know."
Yeah, and what's hilarious as well, so I don't know about you, it was interesting because this character is inherently jovial, or at least inherently positive. And yet at the end, he describes everything positively. He describes how the two farmers decided that because they were going to sign away their land to get this candle, they put their land in debt, and that was what the whole scam was about, was that these two con men would come up, get their land, then they'd go into the mines and die or whatever, and then they'd have the deeds that said, "I have your land." Woo! So the two farmers now realize how important their land is, and so they gave Clay and Sarah Ann parts of their land when they were married, and then they get married, and it's all very sweet, and John plays at their marriage. And it's all very nice. And John casually mentions that they kept the golden slippers. And I can't help but feel like there is something ominous about that. Because, as they say, where did the slippers come from? And importantly, why would they be notable to mention that they are still there? And I just got this slightly uncomfortable feeling of, this is too happy. What's wrong? Because the story just ends. It ends. Yep. They get married and it ends. It's like, something's going to happen after this story finishes. and I feel like it's not going to be good.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And so it is a portent. It is an omen. And John's just too kind of happy to notice it. It could just be that after everything, they came back and they didn't end up with any gold. And maybe we just needed a win. Maybe we just didn't, like, we didn't need to be a sitcom episode where everything goes back to zero. That at the very least, Sarah Ann got her golden slippers and they realized the value of their land. And that's the win. But who knows?
I also don't think that John is a paranoid man. I feel like it's not so much that John will have gone, oh, they need a win, and more, he's not going to have been bothered whether or not they are suspicious, because, okay, it's not like he can do anything about it. He's not going to say to them, no, don't have these. It's sort of like, he's seen so much in his time that I feel like he felt like a very quiet man in terms of personality, meaning that he is not one to insist that he knows better than everyone else, unless it is to do explicitly with something he does in fact know. Like, there's a great line where when the ancient, which is actually Aaron Ahan, oh, for God's sake,
Aramamam,
when he appears as the ancient, John walks up with his guitar and Reed says, take care. And he says, let that thing take care. And I thought, oh, that's such a cool line. So we get this sort of feel that he, when it comes to things he knows, which is monsters and monster hunting, he is fully happy to take charge and be like, no, I know what I'm doing. But everything else, I got the feeling he was much more calm and reserved and sort of like, you know what? I don't know if those golden slippers are going to cause death and mayhem or they're just golden slippers. And these people don't seem to be fussed about it, so who am I to say any otherwise?
So this might come back to the whole religious thing. Maybe because they had the good sense to return the gold, even though it may not have come back to bite them in the ass, but they knew that that was some kind of like ill gain and they couldn't risk it. They wouldn't risk it. Even going back and saving the two con men, like that is on paper like a Christian thing. Maybe there's just nothing that spikes. There's no morality tale about keeping these slippers. It was a gift and it was given, and there's nothing ominous that could possibly come from that. It's not a D&D manual where the slippers are cursed. It's like, no, they were gained, and they were gained in a way that would not offend our kind of like goodness and wholesomeness. So there's just nothing, that it has no power. It can't possibly have power over us. A cursed object is something that is older. A cursed object is some bad thing or some ill intent can be imbued in an item. I feel like in their worldview is that you can't imbue an item with ill intent, because the item can only be imbued with it if it's ill-gotten by whoever's got it next. If something bad happened to it in the past, then that's not on them. Maybe. I don't know.
That's an interesting point, and I wonder. So in the story, they go to get the magic candle, because that's what the piece of paper says, which is all set up, of course. And then he goes and makes a big fuss about making the magic candle, which he manages to make very quickly. And then he says, the candle will go out when you're near your treasure. And it does. Whoop. And as they know, they probably didn't realize that there was actually going to be treasure there.
Yeah.
So do we actually think that the candle was magic, or did it just go out?
No, I mean, it had to be planned. It had to be that the con men kind of like were able to make it go out at a certain time or something like that.
But that doesn't have to be magic.
No, it doesn't have to be magic. Maybe it was magic, but it wasn't doing what they think it was.
No, I guess so. What I'm asking is, does that mean, do we get the implication then? Because I'm starting to think about that more and more. That the only actually magical people in this world, in this story specifically, are John and the Ancient, or whatever it is the Ancient left behind, and that everything else is just pawn. Which is why the slippers would be safe as well.
Yep. I think Reed is purely a con. I think everything he did at the campsite or at supper was a con. I think Aram is a little magic, because like I said, the strings affected him. So he probably knows how to do minor glamours and some dark arts.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but not I think it's like by his nature, he would kind of like, if this was a D&D manual, he'd be like spewing some kind of like dark magics. You know, you'd be able to detect it with a detect magic.
That makes sense.
But
yeah.
But whether he can channel it in any kind of like useful way, it'll probably just be minor glamours, such as like the candle going out at the right time.
Yeah. Okay.
Even then, the creature, when Aram is pretending to be the ancient, he's got a skull in his hand. He's like, ooh. And the skull seems to have gleaming eyes. And they go and examine it later. And it's just tinfoil.
Yeah.
It's tinfoil in the eyes.
He stuck tinfoil in the eyes so it reflected the light.
So even real dark wizards need a little bit of a hand every now and then to pull off the right effect.
Well, that sort of makes me... That's sort of why I wonder whether or not there is actually magic in any of them. Because I wonder... I know the strings, he says they affect...
Witchy stuff.
Witchy stuff. But maybe Aram is only descended from ancients. He's not actually got any of their power.
Oh, he might not be ancient at all. He might just be a dark priest.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think all the stories are revolved around the ancients in the other stories.
No.
Yeah. He might just be a dark priest.
Let's say the ancients as a creature were limited to this area. I thought that was something, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Even the ambiguity about what happened to them is like, well, maybe their hair went white because it was stressed out. You hear about that all the time, right? Mm. But the idea that they got stuck for a day and aged like 20 years or something like that, and it's just left. It's not explored at all. It's just like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
They had glints in their eyes like a dog as well.
I guess that's actually something that I wonder if the other stories like that, where the people that matter are the people that are explained. But ultimately, John is very zen, weirdly enough.
He is.
Meanders through life. He experiences life as it is. He doesn't try and investigate further. He just does what needs to be done and then keeps going. He quite literally lives in the moment. Because, yeah, as you say, he sees these people and goes, huh, they look like 20 to 30 years older than they did yesterday. Okay.
Weird.
Yeah, well, I don't think he even goes weird. He's just like,
huh, how about that?
Yeah, wow. I don't think they'd fit into society anymore. You go on.
Yeah, I think he says like, they'll grow out of it.
Yeah.
Everything's beautifully matter of fact. I really love this. I am definitely going to look for a nice, hopefully a hardcover, maybe a softcover. Add this to my new bookshelf.
Yes, absolutely.
And no, point it out to friends and say you should read this, and they never will.
No, it's very worth reading. It's a good, really good story. I really, really enjoyed this one. It's a lot of fun.
I just realized that this podcast is basically just us forcing weird tales on people that we just desperate for our friends to read and they never will. But now you have to listen. And to all my friends who are listening, thank you for indulging us.
Likewise. It's very kind of you.
I really love that. I am going to go read more. I'm going to dig up that Hellboy story if I can find it in the boxes of my moving crap. Aiden, what are we reading next episode?
Next episode, we are going to be doing a Lovecraft story, the OG, The Color Out of Space.
Is this our first Lovecraft story?
It is actually our first Lovecraft story. We have done Lovecraftian, and we've even done pre-Lovecraft. We've never actually done Lovecraft himself.
Yeah, interesting. And this is Color Out of Space. I am looking forward to what you think about this. We are going back to pastoral Old West as well. And this is a good one. This is an interesting one. Definitely an interesting one to start with.
We're continuing the theme of rural America, because that was something I remember reading a while ago. Someone pointed out that Lovecraft was like a Massachusetts kid. Every time you read the highbrow, really weird eldritch horror that he writes, imagine it in that accent, and suddenly everything sounds completely different.
Yeah, well, there's a guy called Andrew Lehman who's part of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. He does readings of Lovecraft stuff. In fact, it's probably even worth tracking down Andrew Lehman's reciting of this one, Color Out of Space. I will put a link in the show notes if I find them.
Yep.
And he does speak with that New England accent, that pan-Atlantic... the ground swelled with a... Yeah, it's good stuff. And nice. his voice is the only voice that I hear when I read Lovecraft.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
He has a nervousness and kind of like unease that rises in the tense moments. That does such a good job.
Okay, I will have to have a listen.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to develop my Andrew Lehman impersonation because it's really, really good.
Yes, well, that's the next episode. We'll get you all caught up on that story when we get to that one.
Yep.
Thank you very much for the suggestion for this episode. That was a really fun one. I very much enjoyed that. We'll have to come back to Mr. Manly Man.
We will have to come back to the manliest of men. Always looking out for good examples of positive masculinity, and this is definitely it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Thank you very much, guys, and we'll see you next episode. You can find me at Instagram at DoubleScars.
And you can find me on Instagram at ShadeP99.
And we will see you next episode.
Bye, everyone.